Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Twin City Fire Insurance Company versus Faith D. Davis from Dallas County. University of Texas Medical School of Houston and others versus Alan Thong from Harris County. Bonnie Crotham versus William Wakeman Jr. and others from Dallas County. And Enrique Padilla versus Ernest J. LaFrance and others from Harris County. In each of these four causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. The petitioner or petitioners may reserve a portion of the time allotted to them for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court, and if you would like to listen to a recording of the arguments, you may make application with the clerk. We are ready to hear arguments from petitioner in Twin City Fire versus Davis.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioners reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In a number of recent cases, this court has carefully refined the distinction between contractual causes of action for recovery of insurance benefits and tort causes of action for the unreasonable denial of payment or delay in payment of such benefits. This case presents the court with an opportunity to further refine that distinction. In most of its prior cases, the court's primary focus was on the differing substantive standards between the contract and tort causes of action. At issue in this case are different standards for measuring damages, and the necessity for a damage finding unambiguously traceable to a tort theory of recovery as a prerequisite for exemplary damages. The jury in this case made five key findings. First, bad faith by Twin City in the processing of Ms. Davis' claim. Second, failure by Twin City to pay benefits that it contracted with her to pay in the compromise settlement agreement. Third, $3,500 in insurance benefits, quote unquote, wrongfully withheld. The jury failed, fourth, to find any physical pain or mental anguish associated with Twin City's bad faith. But it nevertheless, fifth, assessed $100,000 in exemplary damages. The trial court disregarded the exemplary damage finding, holding that finding immaterial in the light of the absence of any finding of actual damages in tort. The Court of Appeals reinstated the exemplary damage finding on the basis of language of this court in Vail that unfair refusal to pay a claim results as a matter of law in actual damages in at least the amount of the benefits wrongfully withheld.
Mr. Young, if Ms. Davis had submitted only the tort of bad faith and had not submitted any breach of contract issue under Vail, would there be anything wrong with the judgment rendered, or the Court of Appeals judgment?
Yes, Your Honor, unless she obtained a finding of actual damages unambiguously traceable to the tort theory of recovery. Here, the...
Well, Vail said, I thought that the amount of the withheld benefits were as a matter of law.
That is correct, and if that holding is applied in this case, then we are unsuccessful.
Okay, so your argument depends on us overruling Vail.
At least as to that sentence. There are many other things in Vail, but that is correct. We believe that portion of Vail was wrong when it was decided and is doubly wrong in light of this court's more recent holdings in Federal Express versus Dutchman and Transportation Insurance versus Moriel.
Well, to put a finer point on it, you actually think that it's right in some circumstances, just not every circumstance.
That is correct, Your Honor, that the wrong aspect of that language from Vail is that as a matter of law, the damages flow from the withheld benefits.
And you concede that there are circumstances when the contract damages, the benefits withheld, are the measure of damages for bad faith.
Well, I want to stop a little short of conceding that because Moriel draws a careful distinction between the contract and the tort damages and says there are policy reasons why we do that. It's important to keep those causes of action separate. But I would concede that there are situations where logically applying the rules of proximate cause it would follow that but for the bad faith, the benefits would have been paid, and so in that sense, the benefits are appropriate damages.
Those circumstances were not presented in Vail.
Those circumstances were the only circumstances presented in Vail. That is to say, in the context in which the Vail court spoke, it may have been that as a matter of undisputed fact, the actual damages were the benefits wrongfully withheld. But certainly that is not true in every case, and it does not obviate the necessity for a finding of actual damages unambiguously traceable to a tort theory of recovery.
Mr. Young, if we were to overrule that portion of Vail, wouldn't it, in all fairness, be appropriate for us to remand this for a new trial in the interest of justice, inasmuch as plaintiff's counsel may, in fact, have relied upon controlling the Supreme and in submitting the issues in this case?
I have thought about that, Your Honor, and that might well be appropriate. That would be for this court to decide. On the one hand, punitive damages are really not an entitlement of the plaintiff. They are something designed to punish the defendant, and so one has a different right to try one's case for punitive damages than for actual damages. On the other hand, the court did the same thing in Morial, which was a punitive damage case, and it may choose to consider doing that. Now, before doing that, the court would have to consider and overrule our point number two, which relates to the lack of trial court jurisdiction and collateral estoppel.
While we're still on this point number one, it seems to me the rule you advocate is that if an insurance company can do whatever it wants as far as denying a claim, and there really are not going to be any damages assessed against that, you know, other than what old insurance code 3.62 provides, other than the 12% and all, unless something they do causes mental anguish or some essentially abnormal consequential damages. And what Arnold seems to have done is to have made a contract into a tort action, it seems to me. And by requiring any plaintiff who wants to take advantage of this to erect some sort of mental anguish damages, aren't we encouraging perjury or encouraging exaggerated symptoms, asking people to get upset about some of the things that in life just happen?
Of course, this court has before it the question of what quality of evidence will suffice to support a mental anguish recovery. And I don't want to get into the merits of that issue. But the fact is that Morial made a careful distinction between the various types of damages which might flow and identified such things as mental anguish damages as matters which flow from bad faith but not from breach of contract. Additionally, as Justice Hecht indicated, our primary position is not that contractual damages can never be bad faith damages. It's that they may or may not be on a case-by-case basis. And what the plaintiff who wants to recover bad faith damages needs to do at a minimum is obtain a jury finding that but for the bad faith of the insurance company, she would have in fact been paid those contractual benefits. That may be true in some bad faith cases. It is not true in every bad faith case as a matter of law.
How does that help you in this case?
Go ahead. Why is that not true here?
That is not true here because there are several bases in the verdict that the jury could have found bad faith, and the evidence that the jury could have found bad faith, that don't necessarily mean that the $3,500 was withheld in bad faith. The processing of this claim was an iterative process. Several things were done that the plaintiff complained showed the insurance company's bad faith. In particular, the jury may have found that if the insurance company had conducted a reasonable investigation, it would have immediately paid $150 or some other lesser amount toward an over-the-tub Whirlpool unit, when in fact that was the minimum reasonable thing to do, even though it ultimately found that contractually the company was liable for the full $3,500. So we can't say in this case that as a matter of the jury's verdict and as a matter of law under the evidence, the bad faith resulted in the withholding of $3,500 in benefits. The $3,500 were, quote, wrongfully withheld, and we don't know whether the jury thought it was wrongful because it was in breach of contract, or because it was wrongful because it was in bad faith, or it was wrongful because it was a deceptive trade practice. We have nothing linking the $3,500 with the bad faith, and it doesn't necessarily flow under the evidence.
Is the $3,500, though, the cost of the deluxe hot tub?
Well, there were three types of hot tubs, and it's the cost of the deluxe above-ground version, not the one that's built into the ground like your swimming pool might be.
So why can't we conclude that the jury believed that the insurance company should have paid for the deluxe?
Should have, in the contractual sense, I think they did conclude that. Should have, as that being the only reasonable thing to do in default of which the company was in bad faith, we don't know whether they thought that or not, because there were several other scenarios under the evidence that they may have thought was the minimum good faith conduct that fell short of paying the $3,500.
Are you suggesting that they could have found as tort damages a failure to provide an over the tub jacuzzi or whirlpool, but they could have, as a matter of contract, found that they failed to provide the deluxe?
That is one scenario. Another scenario would be that there were no tort damages at all, that had the company conducted a reasonable good faith investigation, it would have discovered a reasonable good faith basis to deny the claim altogether. We have, in fact, the finding of the jury on the contractual dispute. Twin Cities said that it was only obligated to pay reasonable and necessary medical expenses. Ms. Davis said we were obligated to pay all of Dr. Key's prescribed medical expenses, whether reasonable or not. Well, the jury resolved that contract interpretation question in favor of Ms. Davis, but it may have found that had we conducted a reasonable investigation, we would have had a good faith belief, basis to believe that the damages were not medically necessary, that the hot tub was not medically necessary, even though they then went on to find that as a matter of the contract interpretation, we were obligated to pay those. So the tort damages that the jury found in reality may have been zero, or may have been $150, or may have been $3,500, or may have been some other number for all I know. But we have nothing indicating which of those numbers is the actual tort damages. In the Dutchman case, which was an employment termination case, without revisiting the substantive issue of bad faith in the employment context, this court reversed and rendered a punitive damage award on the basis that although the plaintiff had obtained a finding of contractual damages, it had obtained no findings of damages for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. That is precisely our situation here. And so we don't know under the Dutchman case what, if anything, the jury would have found as actual tort damages. The trial court correctly recognized that there is no finding of actual damages in tort on this record and correctly disregarded the exemplary damage award because the finding of wrongfully withheld benefits could plausibly be traced to the contract theory, to the bad faith theory, or to the deceptive trade practice theory. Nothing unambiguously connects it with bad faith, and so it properly disregarded the exemplary damage award. Since the court did not grant writ on our point of error number two, let me touch on it just briefly by saying that the plaintiff's original petition in this case did not evidence an intent to appeal the Industrial Accident Board award, nor seek to set it aside. And therefore, although as the Court of Appeals pointed out, it referred to the award, it did not meet the minimum threshold necessary to invoke the trial court's jurisdiction. And the amended petition filed long after the jurisdictional deadline did not relate back. And for that reason, we believe all of Ms. Davis' claims were jurisdictionally barred and or collaterally estopped. Turning to the point regarding the Court of Appeals treatment of exemplary damages, we've called the court's attention in our letter of supplemental authorities filed this morning to a case decided by the United States Supreme Court in June, the Honda versus Oberg case. And there the court squarely held that the absence of meaningful appellate review of the amount of an exemplary damage award violates the defendant's due process rights. It further held that appellate review of the plaintiff's entitlement to exemplary damages is not enough without appellate review of the amount of those exemplary damages. That is one of our primary complaints about the Court of Appeals' analysis of exemplary damages in this case, that it fails to differentiate the evidence that shows whether the award should have been large or small from the evidence that shows whether or not there should have been an award in the first place.
You do not squarely present a no evidence of punitive damages point.
We did not. We did not anticipate that aspect of the court's Morial decision. Additionally, the Court of Appeals, to put it bluntly, made up facts outside the record. It made up facts contrary to those found by the jury, and it relied on abstract measures of exemplary damages, as evidenced by other cases on dissimilar facts, and as evidenced by a statutory cap that is designed to be the outer limit for punitive damages in all cases, rather than a measure of what is appropriate or inappropriate in a given case. And so because it did not particularize its analysis in this case, we believe at a minimum that there is a Morial, Kiever, Poole versus Ford Motor error in the Court of Appeals analysis of the exemplary damage question. In summary, the jury found that Faith Davis was not injured by Twin Cities' bad faith conduct in any way that would not have resulted from a simple breach of contract. Indeed, it failed to find unambiguously that she was injured at all by Twin Cities' bad faith conduct. Under these circumstances, the precedents of this court and the lower courts, logical application of the principles of bad faith law and proximate causation, dictate that the exemplary damage award in this case was properly disregarded by the trial court. Unless the court has any questions, that concludes my argument.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dale Tillery will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court. In response, I think it's critical for this court to note that Twin City, in their attack, completely failed to attack a gross negligence finding. And in essence, that's what their complaint is. While they frame it as an attack upon Vail, and the point, the only point before this court in that regard is the fact that they feel like benefit of the bargain damages cannot sustain an exemplary damage award. That's much different than using the standard this court has put forth in Morial and saying there is insufficient evidence or no evidence to support the jury's finding of gross negligence. Their attack is more semantic and legal gymnastics than substance. This court...
Is it your position that benefits withheld is always the damages in a bad faith case is a matter of law?
Justice Heck, I've given this great consideration. And with all due respect to Mr. Young, he has gone through in his briefing some tortured arguments to say, in theory, conceptually, it may not be. And I am open to that concept that in every single hypothetical creature that we can imagine, there may be one where it wasn't. But in this case, it clearly was. Because all this case was about was the utter refusal of the insurance company to pay a medical expense that the doctor specifically required. And the insurance company said, tell me the necessity. And I think that's our point here. Using the Morial test, we have protections against unfounded claims, claims where there should be no or was no evidence of gross negligence. We have that standard now. We have to prove with evidence in the record that there is harm or a threat of serious injury that's independent and qualitatively different from a mere breach. Did we have that in this case? Is that evidence in the record? If we're going to go ahead and do an analysis as to whether or not there's sufficient evidence to sustain the jury's finding of gross negligence, which they have not perfected, but if we're going to engage in that, so we can see in the crucible of law whether or not Morial works, this is a perfect case. There is qualitatively different and independent serious threat of harm to Faith Davis that was known by the insurance company when they refused to pay the medical expense.
But
their own doctor.
But the measure of damages is the same, you contend, at least insofar as the hot tub is concerned.
Certainly, I agree that as this court set out in Morial, that there are three types of damages that may be awarded when you have a bad faith finding. One of them is benefit of the bargain. That is not a novel concept. This court ruled that in Mangus v. Carrera. It has ruled it in Ranger v. Gwynn. The same argument would apply to the salaries damage. It's mere contractual damage. And I think what's important to note is that this court addressed that dichotomy in Delaney, where the court said, well, we've got this contort situation out there that keeps popping up. Now, what's the test we're going to apply? And I think it's instructive to note that Justice Grant's dissent in the Court of Appeals in Delaney pointed out that sort of the best test is there a breach of a duty in law, or is there only a breach of the obligations created by the agreement of the parties? This court has repeatedly held Chetsey, Arnold, Natividad, breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing is a breach of a duty in a law. So if you focus solely on the economic loss, as Justice Grant pointed out in his dissent in Delaney, you're missing the ball when we have a duty created by law that's breached.
So we never look to the damages claim to determine the nature of the cause of action?
I would not, just as Justice Heck pointed out, that to have an absolute, to say never do you have a situation where the benefit of the bargain is not a damage in bad faith, I wouldn't say that absolutely never, but I would say clearly in this case.
Was there evidence in this case of any damages from bad faith other than the benefits withheld?
Was there evidence of threat of serious harm qualitatively and independently different?
No, of any damages. Any damage.
The only damage finding by the jury.
Was there evidence of any of it?
Yes, sir.
And what was that?
The Court of Appeals details harm that Ms. Davis
I'm
suffered.
About the harm, but was there
an actual jury
$10 of damages due to delay or some other aspect of it?
No, sir. The only damage finding of the jury was the punitive and the wrongfully withheld. Naturally, this case was submitted precisely according to the pattern jury charge, in which if one wants to argue there is no connector or finding of a connection between the bad faith conduct and the damage, I would submit that wrongfully withheld is certainly a higher standard than mere proximate cause. And in this case, despite some misinformation to the contrary, if one reviews the jury charge, there was not ever submitted a breach of contract issue.
How can you say wrongfully withheld is a higher standard than proximate cause, which requires foreseeability?
Well, proximate cause would be naturally flowing from, without necessarily wrongful, a higher level, some animus, some intent, some label that has the law has already put upon an act as not being countenanced. Proximate cause does not have that higher possibility associated with it. Now, look at the jury finding. Every issue spins off a jury question one and two without an answer to one or two. Number one was DTPA, basically. Number two was the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Every finding after that was conditioned upon a yes answer to at least one of those two findings. If there was not a yes answer to one of those two findings, there wouldn't have been any other findings in the case. The submission or the question that the carrier brings up about what they feel like is the reasonable and necessary, that's because the carrier urged to the court that despite the specific language of the agreement that said we will pay all necessary all medical expenses, the defense said, no, although our language says that, we can only contract in accordance with the law, and that has a reasonable necessary standard. So in a defensive posture, that comes in to say, if this wasn't a reasonable necessary expense, regardless of the language of the agreement, they had a defense as a matter of law that it didn't meet that standard. It was not a breach of contract submission. So one looks at this case and boils it down to what was it about, what was plainly submitted, what was plainly questioned, and if you read jury question number 2, which is the bad faith, it is completely dependent on a finding that the failure to pay the claim, and what claim did we have? Only one claim, the medical expense. The failure to pay that claim, was it in bad faith? The jury answered yes. What was the amount that they failed to pay or they wrongfully withheld? $3,500. The defense, in an artful argument, creates a concept that, well, maybe this could be for something else. I submit to this court, if the jury felt like, well, really, the insurance company only owed $150, wouldn't that what you put for wrongfully withheld? You wrongfully withheld $150? The insurance company said, but we tendered $150. All the better. If the jury believed that was the reasonable amount to pay, the jury would have said zero was wrongfully withheld. But what did the jury say? This conduct is abhorrent. It's the clearest case I believe this court will see of an insurance company acting with without any control whatsoever. And the jury said they wrongfully withheld the $3,500 medical expense. And the only issue before this court in that regard is not whether or not there's sufficient evidence to sustain the gross negligence finding. They didn't challenge that. They may have an argument for that, and we can use the Morial experience to test that. They simply said, as a matter of law, the benefit of the bargain will not support punitive damage finding because it's not actual tort damages. I disagree. The authorities are replete before this court, long and historic. The finding is just, and the jury was right.
Moving to the amount of punitive damages.
Yes, Your Honor. Very, very good point here. Once again, the insurance carrier failed to perfect its error in that regard because, as this court pointed out in Morial, on page 31 of Morial, this court said, the Court of Appeals had no duty to detail the evidence which supports the jury's award of the amount of punitives unless the Court of Appeals is affirming a punitive damage award over a challenge that the jury's award is based on insufficient evidence or the evidence is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. As Justice Cornyn insightfully questioned counsel, they did not make such a challenge. And under Morial, the Court of Appeals had no duty to make such detailed findings. Now, with that in mind, I submit to this court, the Court of Appeals did exactly what this court wants the Court of Appeals to do.
Why did the petitioner have to challenge it if they won in the trial?
On appeal, to preserve their error to this court, once the Court of Appeals reinstated the award,
You mean they're not arguing in this court that it's excessive?
Actually, well, they argued below and once again in this court that it is excessive. That is not the same as arguing that that amount is not based upon sufficient evidence in the record, or that the jury's finding is against the great weight of preponderance.
What's the difference?
The difference is if you look at what the carrier submitted as a challenge, they complained on a mechanical application that this is excessive because it's more than ratios that have historically been recognized. That's not questioning the evidence. That's not pointing out to the Court of Appeals, look here, there's no evidence of this. There's no evidence of this. There's no evidence of each of the Krauss factors. They didn't even help the Court of Appeals along in that regard. They simply said that this is over a mechanical application that has somewhat been recognized as a trend, never pointing out the absence of any evidence regarding any factor that Krauss recognized. Now, I submit to this court that the Court of Appeals did, in fact, offer a particularized statement to support the award.
Four sentences in the CA opinion.
I would say that I have not counted periods, I would say let's focus on the substance of those four sentences.
All right.
And in those four sentences contain facts which justified the award, which would impact and reflect upon the Krauss factors. And I would say not just that, Justice, but also the introductory fact statement should also be used to recognize the entire concept. I mean, we were nitpicking the Court of Appeals for not maybe putting enough periods in. I think we should look at the substance of it.
Well, of course, it's not quite that simple. Your question really is, have they considered not only the evidence supporting an award, not just of punitive damages, but of $100,000 in punitive damages, over 28 times the actual damages. But have they also looked at the evidence that would be, that would weigh against such an award? The paragraph in which they deal with this does list some supporting evidence. Doesn't Morial require them to list the opposing evidence?
What if there is none?
So your position is there isn't.
There wasn't any. This was
reasonable handed. Minds could not differ that $100,000 of punitive damages ought to be awarded in this case.
Oh, we're talking about purely, once again, a mechanical application of a number. But if you ask me, was there evidence in the record that would support a lesser amount, the fact that the Court of Appeals didn't say, well, we also find that the carrier submitted this to mitigate the conduct, but we don't believe it, or whatever, to justify reducing the amount, I simply say that that evidence wasn't present, and so the Court of Appeals could not manufacture and print what did not exist. Now, once again, in preserving their error, had the carrier presented in its attack upon against the great weight or sufficiency of the evidence, what they felt like existed in the record, maybe we would have something to look at, but now we're asking the Court of Appeals to manufacture out of thin air evidence that wasn't present. And that's why they didn't list the factor, because there wasn't any mitigating factors. The amount, certainly within the providence of the jury. I will point out to this court another factor which made it very difficult for the Court of Appeals in setting forth the factors, the evidence going to Krauss, is the fact that the carrier objected and had sustained by the trial court the introduction of the net worth of the carrier. But then the carrier comes in and says, there's no evidence before the court to control or to reflect upon the evidentiary requirement of Krauss of the ability or capability of the carrier to pay this damage. They feed at the trough, yet they don't want to be bound by the action. That would have been another factor that the Court of Appeals could have placed in there. So I feel like they have not failed to properly invoke the duty of the Court of Appeals to engage in the type of particularized analysis that this court requires in Morreale, because they didn't properly perfect the error. But I also feel like that the Court of Appeals did, maybe they could have done a better job. Maybe they could have done a lengthier job. But I don't believe there is a failure, because the substance of the four sentences that they set forth completely justify the award of the jury. The final point of error, or I guess the cross application that we brought forth to this court, concerned the calculation of the attorney's fees and the damages. Certainly there's, basically we just simply say that recovery included the attorney's fees award, and the attorney's fees award should be in there. There's a divergent view regarding the calculation, but we feel like including the attorney's fees in the recovery is the proper way.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court. Our third point of error indeed was properly preserved. We raised, as Rule 324C requires, a conditional cross point in the Court of Appeals. I believe the respondent gives too short a shrift to our argument under that cross point, and it did not merely concern itself with numerical ratios, but argued more generally that the exemplary damage award was excessive. That was also preserved in our motion for rehearing in the Court of Appeals, and so the Morreale error on that point is properly before the court. A tort recovery, of course, consists of a duty, a breach, and damages. In this case, it's not about duty. There is a duty of good faith and fair dealing. It's not about breach. We do not question in this court the bad faith finding. It is instead about damages. And I must disagree with Mr. Tillery when he says that all this case was about was the failure to pay $3,500. The plaintiff attacked everything Twin City did from the day the claim first came in until the time the case went to the jury, arguing that each and every part of it was bad faith. And once again, the jury may have found that the failure to pay $3,500 was the bad faith. It may have found that the failure to pay a lesser amount was the bad faith. Or it may have found that the failure to conduct a reasonable investigation leading to a reasonable basis for denial was the bad faith. Mr. Tillery said that Morreale requires that insureds receive protection, and I submit to you that they will receive protection when insurance companies are held liable for the damages, the actual damages, which their bad faith conduct proximately causes. And we have no finding of that in this case. What we say is a little bit different from what Mr. Tillery says that we say. He said, and I quote, as a matter of law, benefit of the bargain damages will not support exemplary damages. I would twist that around a little bit and say it this way. Benefit of the bargain damages do not, as a matter of law, support exemplary damages. That is our position in this case, that they do not, as a matter of law, support them, and there is no finding, as a matter of fact, to support them. And for that reason, the exemplary damages in this case cannot stand. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the court's argument in the first cause, and we will now take a brief recess.